Studio 360 is supported by Arts Brookfield, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary with Art Set Free, a global art showcase offering emerging, established, and amateur artists everywhere the opportunity to share their art with millions worldwide. Details at artsbrookfield25.com.
Today in Studio 360.
Uncle Tom, body of work!
You can't call someone that if you've never read the book!
People think that Uncle Tom was like a water-toting,
shuffling, kowtowing, you know, sniveling coward.
In the latest installment of our series on American icons, we look at the novel Uncle Tom's Cabin and wonder, what's so bad about being an Uncle Tom?
If I'm an Uncle Tom, that means I am compassionate. I'm making the best out of challenging circumstances. I'll take that.
I'll also talk with the actor Jeffrey Wright. Wright has played some good, even saintly characters. Martin Luther King comes to mind. But in his new role on Boardwalk Empire, he gets to play the bad guy.
Where you going, friend? As far as you'd like me to take you. But we shall go there together.
I'm Kurt Anderson. All that and more in this hour of Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC, right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity. Lumosity.com daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com. And by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting 12 Years a Slave, the true story of a man who overcame more than a decade of injustice to reclaim his freedom. Now playing.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today on the show, I'll talk with the actor Jeffrey Wright about his new role on Boardwalk Empire, and I'll also talk with the novelist Alice McDermott. McDermott has won the National Book Award, but she's still got ambitions.
I always think if I were a really, really wonderful writer, I'd be a poet. If I were a really wonderful writer, I'd be a short story writer. And I'm not quite up there yet.
That's later this hour. But right now, we're going to continue our American Icon series with a look at one of the most beloved American fictional characters of the 19th century, an important avatar for anti-slavery sentiment, who in the 20th century became an infamous caricature, Uncle Tom.
You just acting just like an old Uncle Tom. A mother fly cop. I'm going to punish you.
Let me tell you something, man. You ain't got no money.
Back off of me.
That's from 1967, Muhammad Ali yelling at Ernie Terrell before their championship fight. 115 years after Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, in which the fictional slave, Tom, convinced millions of people that slaves were human and slavery evil. So how did things go so wrong for Uncle Tom in just a century? KUOW's Phyllis Fletcher has the story in this episode of American Icons.
I know one black person who would admit to me in public that she's read Uncle Tom's Cabin, and nobody even made her do it.
I'm thinking it was probably the third or the fourth grade.
Sakara Ramu is a Seattle area writer. She found the book in her Catholic school library.
There is always kind of a section in the back of the library where there were books that you just kind of knew as a kid were kind of risque.
You never checked them out because you didn't want to call attention to them.
And one of the books for me was Uncle Tom's Cabin.
She could tell from the drawing on the front that it had something to do with slavery.
It made me uncomfortable when I looked at it, and I knew that it had historic significance. And slavery was not something that was talked about in school. So it was pretty much, you know, the cover. I judged the book by the cover in this case.
She read Uncle Tom's Cabin during library period in the next couple weeks. She didn't tell anyone, even though the book really moved her. So did the character Uncle Tom.
He was extremely compassionate, and he was a transformative figure for the people around him. He was very powerful, even though he seemingly had no power.
What he did in the story was a very brave thing to do. He died to save these women.
That's Carver Gayton. One of the main characters in Uncle Tom's Cabin, George Harris, is based on his great-grandfather, a former slave named Lewis Clark. Stowe wrote that she interviewed Clark extensively when she was researching her book. Clark told Stowe about a man he knew who was beaten viciously by his masters.
And he said, if God forgives them, I did nothing wrong, and God forgives them, I'll forgive them. And that's, if you read Uncle Tom's Cabin, what Uncle Tom said right before he perished, it's almost the exact same words.
He's a poor, miserable critter. It's awful to think on. Oh, if he only could repent, the Lord would forgive him now. He ain't done me no real harm. Only opened the gate of the kingdom for me. That's all.
Okay. If you try to read Uncle Tom's Cabin today, you might end up cringing in the fetal position, rolling your eyes with your shirt pulled up over your nose. It is sentimental. The dialect and some of the scenes are over the top. Some of the characters are crazy stereotypes. And like a lot of things that seem racist now, Gayton says the book is a product of its time.
She said that blacks are, you know, they're meek and they're, you know, they're more Christian than whites, and particularly white males. You know, she was like a lot of abolitionists and a lot of the people of the Victorian era that they were patronizing. They felt as though they were part of this elite class. They knew what was best for black people.
Harriet Beecher Stowe was a New Englander. She was living in Maine with her husband and children when Congress cracked down on runaway slaves. She started to write a fiction series in an abolitionist newspaper about slaves and their quests for freedom. A mother who crossed a freezing river on foot with her baby so they wouldn't be separated in a sail.
The huge green fragment of ice on which she alighted pitched and creaked as her weight came on it. But she stayed there not a moment. With wild cries and desperate energy, she leaped to another and still another, cake tumbling, leaping, slipping, springing upwards again. Her shoes are gone, her stockings cut from her feet, while blood marked every step. But she saw nothing, felt nothing, till dimly as in a dream she saw the Ohio side and a man helping her up the bank.
The man who encouraged them to go? Uncle Tom. Tom had chances to try to escape, and he didn't. Tom was literally sold down the river. On the boat, he saved a slave owner's child, little Eva, from drowning. The child's family bought him. Tom played with Eva and took care of her until she died of tuberculosis.
He made people question how they perceived him initially and how they treated him and how they believed people like him should be treated and what that meant about who they were as people.
And then...
Uncle Tom, you know, was beaten to death by Simon Legree. Beaten to death because he would not give the names of two runaway female slaves.
Do you know? I made up my mind to kill you. I have done just that thing, Tom. Unless you'll tell me what you know about these year gals. Do you hear? Speak! Do you know anything?
I know, Massa. But I can't tell anything. I can die.
I can die, he says. That's pretty tough.
People think that Uncle Tom was like a water-toting...
shuffling, a kowtowing, you know, sniveling coward.
But those people haven't read the book.
I think they're reflecting on a perspective of what transpired, you know, after the book came out.
And I was really surprised when I read the novel that Uncle Tom wasn't really an Uncle Tom in the way that we think of the term today.
Adina Spingarn was in grad school at Harvard when she read Uncle Tom's Cabin.
And I made a note to myself in my notebook, oh, I should look up how Uncle Tom transformed from this Christ figure in Stowe's novel into a race traitor.
She did look it up and wrote about it and turned it into her dissertation.
So the first time that I find Uncle Tom being used in a negative context that isn't specifically rejection of Uncle Tom's religion is in 1883.
30 years after the novel came out.
And that is when a black New York lawyer named Walter G. Christopher gave a paper to an African-American literary society called the Bethel Historical and Literary Society in Washington, D.C.
He was arguing that blacks should go to trade school instead of college. Not a popular argument today, but back then it was part of a hot debate. To make his point, Christopher said,
Of course, no one wishes to revive the Uncle Tom type of manhood. I despise that as heartily as anyone. But a man who will kick up a row when he knows that he can't win is a fool.
He wanted to distance himself and all Black people from a symbol of a painful past.
There was really a long process in which sometimes Uncle Tom could be referred to in a positive way, sometimes in a negative way.
In the early 20th century, Tom was still a sympathetic figure to many Northern whites and to many Blacks. Black newspapers were publishing new fiction pieces in his voice. And Tom was still a moneymaker. Black actors and white ones in blackface were performing Uncle Tom in plays and vaudeville acts.
It's really in that version that Uncle Tom becomes the Uncle Tom, the passive old cringing sycophant.
That's David Reynolds' take on it. He's a professor at the City University of New York. He looked at how theater companies produced Uncle Tom's Cabin for white audiences.
Most of the play posters portray a bald, stooped man, very arthritic person on a cane, very subservient.
Reynolds says reviewers tended to judge the play on how pathetic Tom was and how dramatically he died. In 1911, a Black theater manager wrote in the Chicago Defender that the Uncle Tom plays had outlived their usefulness.
In the 1910s, Uncle Tom becomes a figure for the old kind of leader, the leader who accommodated too much. And that's when Uncle Tom becomes dangerous.
It was basically downhill for Tom from there. Each generation of Black writers and activists, from Marcus Garvey to James Baldwin, found new reasons to reject Uncle Tom.
Pray for those who use them despitefully. Today, Martin Luther King is just a 20th century or modern Uncle Tom or a religious Uncle Tom who is doing the same thing today to keep Negroes defenseless in the face of attack that Uncle Tom did on the plantation to keep those Negroes defenseless in the face of the attack of the Klan in that day.
Malcolm X said that on TV. A Tom today is someone whose loyalty to white people for personal gain puts other Blacks in danger. And if you're Tracy Jordan on 30 Rock, a Tom reminds you of everything corny about white people.
Ah, dude wears khakis. Uncle Tom, party of one. Uncle Tom, party of one.
You can't call someone that if you've never read the book.
Plush book.
You know what I think? I think you're ashamed of being Black and you're an embarrassment to your community.
Poor Tom. He's a punchline. Not a happy ending. But another main character, George Harris, the one based on Lewis Clark, makes it to Canada, and ultimately back to Africa.
I want a people that shall have a tangible, separate existence of its own. And where am I to look for it? On the shores of Africa, I see a republic. There it is my wish to go, and find myself a people.
The real guy didn't do that. Near the end of his life, Lewis Clark was destitute in Kentucky. A reporter found out who he was, the inspiration for a major character in Uncle Tom's Cabin. He wrote about him. The article went viral. There were calls for the Stowe family to help him out, but they denied he was the real guy. So Carver Gayton is doing what he can to make sure more people know his great-grandfather's story. He helped with a reprint of Clark's slave narrative, and he's writing another book about him. When he meets people who don't want to read Uncle Tom's Cabin, he wants them to at least know the book's place in history.
People forget about the fact that the anti-slavery movement was on the ropes before that book could come out. The Northerners were not that supportive of challenging militarily, Confederacy, and weren't that concerned about the institution of slavery. But that book changed perspectives.
If you look at it the right way, it could change your perspective even now. You could think of Tom as a hero.
There aren't too many people that I know of, outside of a Martin Luther King, who would put their life on the line like that for other people.
As for Sakara Remu, the writer in Seattle, she's been called an Uncle Tom. She knows it's supposed to be an insult, but she doesn't take it that way.
If I'm an Uncle Tom, that means I am compassionate. I'm making the best out of challenging circumstances. Like, I'll take that. I'll take that.
For Studio 360, I'm Phyllis Fletcher.
You can let us know what you think of that piece at studio360.org. While you're there, you can also nominate your American icon. What book or movie or work of art helps you understand what it means to be an American? We've been getting some fantastic suggestions over the last few weeks, from The Velvet Underground and Nico to The Plastic Pink Flamingo. And Tess Foley from Connecticut is lobbying for Charlotte's Web.
When people read Charlotte's Web, I know we're reading what's supposed to be a fictitious story about farm animals in a barn, but that's really the world that we all live in all the time.
My name, said the spider, is Charlotte. Charlotte what? Asked Wilbur eagerly. Charlotte A. Cavatica, but just call me Charlotte. I think you're beautiful, said Wilbur. Well, I am pretty, replied Charlotte. There's no denying that. Almost all spiders are rather nice-looking. I'm not as flashy as some, but I'll do.
And the actions that this supposedly repugnant spider takes to step up and call attention to the beautiful worth and value of a little tiny runt pig, that's what we're all called to do for each other all the time.
Do you want a friend?
Yes, I want a friend, but I want to live, too.
Well, chin up. I'll be your friend.
We are coming to the end of this round of American Icons, and we'll be choosing one listener suggestion to produce as our final icon of this season.
Chin up, everybody loves a happy face.
You can nominate yours at studio360.org/American Icons. The deadline is October 27th, so hurry.
Let a little sunshine in. You'll be on the right side looking at the bright side, up with your chinny chin chin.
And still ahead.
Where you going, friend? As far as you would like me to take you. But we shall go there together.
The great actor Jeffrey Wright has played a lot of complex characters, but none of them so bad as his current character from the HBO show Boardwalk Empire.
And the speciousness of him and the hypocrisy of him is really kind of delicious to play, loathsome as it is, but also it rings very true to me.
Jeffrey Wright is coming up next in Studio 360. Stay with us.
That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to Maui, open a tequila factory, write poetry, play music again.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
Give up this painting.
Jean-Michel Basquiat, Colin Powell, Martin Luther King Jr. Not a lot of actors could take on all of those roles. And only one, I think, could pull them all off beautifully and memorably. Jeffrey Wright.
There comes a time when time itself is ready for a change. And that time is coming, Montgomery.
Jeffrey Wright is one of that handful of actors who makes any production he's part of more wonderful by being there. He did it 20 years ago in his breakout, Angels in America, and he does it in his most recent part this season on HBO's Boardwalk Empire. He plays the brilliant and complicated and villainous Dr. Valentin Narcisse.
A thing mixed is a thing weakened.
Is that from the Bible?
It is from me.
It's nice for cocktails.
To hide the impurities. But they are there. And with each dilution, the spirit slips away. The spirit and the color. Until nothing authentic is left.
And Jeffrey Wright is here with me now. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks so much, Kurt.
Dr. Narcisse appears out of nowhere this season. It seems as though they wrote this character in just so they could get Jeffrey Wright in the show. And I miss him so far in these episodes whenever he's off screen. Did it read that way when you first saw the script? Oh, this is a great character. I can do great stuff with this.
Absolutely. It's more what they've written than anything that I'm doing. It's the things that they've been coming up with are really very surprising to me and very satisfying to me. I also think it has to do with the period and, you know, a lot of the political dynamics that were awakening at that time. And obviously these writers, you know, led by Howard Korder and Terry Winter are, you know, very attuned to historical detail. That's what makes it so wonderful. Not only is the production design, you know, really specific, but the writing as well. They really try to insert themselves in the most respectful way to the period. And in this case, there's some really fantastic characters emerging from the black liberation standpoint, if you will, or really what how I describe as the kind of founding fathers of the Negro state. You know, you have this great debate ongoing between W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington and Marcus Garvey, who my character in the show is an affiliate of.
I've never seen the historic particulars of race and, as you say, the Negro state and the sort of proto-black power idea dealt with in movies or TV like this.
I felt the same way in reading what they were offering. It's, you know, it's really reflective of this debate. And I use the parlance of the term the Negro, you know, the state of the Negro at the time. But there was this, it was only 60 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. So, you know, what do we now do with this newfound freedom? What direction do we take? And so, you know, you had the Harlem Renaissance as well, which was kind of a celebration of this newfound freedom. And,
which is usually what we see in popular culture depicted, because it's so uplifting,
yes,
as opposed to the highly problematic Dr. Narcisse.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, it was a complicated time. What I love about what they're fleshing out, particularly in the relationship with Chalky White's character,
yeah,
is it's really reflective of this debate that was happening that was very, at times, very personal and very vicious, because you had different philosophies about, you know, whether, you know, that reflected an urbane perspective or northern perspective relative to a southern perspective.
And this class, this intra-black class.
Intra-racial class, complexion politics, all of this stuff that's kind of messy that we don't often explore in pop culture was very much being played out there, and they're in really lyrical, for my character, in really, really lyrical, wonderful prose. They're, you know, they're allowing us to explore this stuff. So I'm describing it as some of the best writing that I've had the opportunity to work with, perhaps ever. I mean, you know, I've had, you know,
guy got famous doing Tony Kushner.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, nothing surpasses Kushner, but this stuff is pretty special, I think.
I want to play a clip from a recent episode. This is your character, Dr. Narcisse, introducing himself to Chalky White, who's a bootlegger and nightclub owner, Mr. Big, in Black Atlantic City.
1 Timothy 2:9. Do you know your Bible, Mr. White?
Better than I know you.
You don't know me at all. Dr. Valentine Narcisse. And you've met Mrs. Pastor. That is established.
Well, what you doing in the private rooms, Doctor?
What choice am I offered? The Libyan performs in your club. The Libyan serves in your club. But the Libyan may not attend your club.
Ain't no Libyans here.
You yourself are one?
Oh, I'm from Texas.
Our roots go deeper than that. Across oceans to the mother continent where all things begin. You're nervous, dear?
Little.
You needn't be. Mr. White is civilized. I am civilized. We're having a civilized conversation. May I sit?
That was Jeffrey Wright and Michael Kenneth Williams in Boardwalk Empire. Your character refers to black people as Libyans. Was that actually a usage back then, or just an invented flourish? A character tick.
Yeah, that is a character tick of in some way, but it's also reflective of, you know, some of the dialogue at the time out of Garvey's movement, but uh-huh. also some of these early Islamic movements as well. You know, there's all of this mythologizing about, you know, the roots and the journey of African-Americans
right.
to this place. And so that's, you know, a part of the mythologizing. Whether or not it's, you know, entirely accurate,
yeah, yeah.
it remains to be seen. But there it is.
History and African-American history seems to be an interest of yours. Does that factor into your decision, like, shall I do this or not?
Well, I'm interested in these things. I think that all stories, even if they ignore those aspects of American culture, still comment on them in absentia in some ways. You know, I think the movies and the plays and the television that we do is propaganda, you know. It's, you know, provides these touchstones, you know, through which we understand these stories. And I like to be a part of the propaganda for the side of of opening up, you know, or helping to open up our eyes to the complexity of American culture and the fullness of America, to be inclusive of all of these things. You know, at the same time, I do, you know, the Hunger Games as well and James Bond movies and things like that. But yeah, I mean, I grew up in Washington, D.C. I was a political science major. These are things that kind of run around in my head. I tend probably to a fault to look through a political lens when I look at the world. And so it would just only be natural that when I act, it's kind of reflective of those interests.
The first gig as a young man that earned you vast acclaim was, of course, the character Belize, the ex-drag queen nurse in Angels in America on stage and then on the HBO adaptation. I have a clip of you from that HBO show describing heaven to a delirious hospital patient.
Big dance palaces full of music and lights and racial impurity and gender confusion. And all the deities are Creole, mulatto, brown as the mouths of rivers. Race, taste, and history finally overcome.
It's actually an interesting story how that piece came to be. That scene didn't exist in the original version of the play, and when we moved it to Broadway, you know, it was in San Francisco, it was in Los Angeles, and then we moved it to Broadway. Tony showed up one morning while we were in rehearsal for Perestroika and presented this speech and scene, which was like one of the great gifts that anyone has ever been given as an actor or could be given. You know, it kind of set me up in several meanings, set me up to the idea that, you know, you can actually be meaningful when you do this make-believe stuff. You know, you ask about, you know, the historical interests and the political interests. It's like, you know, if it's done well and if it's done at the right time and with the right intent, you can be in some way a part of, you know, affecting change in some way. Because, I mean, I don't think it can be oversaid, and it's not a function of me, but certainly a function of Tony Kushner and George Wolfe, who are not only great artists, but are also very serious political activists. And there's no question that Tony wrote this from a point of moral outrage. And so, and he wrote it at a time, along with Larry Kramer and the ACT UP movement and all these other things that were compounded toward pushing rights out in directions in which they, you know, they weren't being enjoyed. And I think some of the advancements that we've seen for the, you know, the lesbian, gay community, transgender community in the last months is in some small part a function of the work that was done by artists like Tony Kushner at that time.
Unlike most actors, there seems to be, as I said, as I raved fulsomely about you, no role you can't do wonders with. But you also, it sounds like, work harder than most actors. I heard this story that on the set of Broken Flowers, the Jim Jarmusch film from almost 10 years ago, you spent a lot of your time off camera phoning the Ethiopian embassy to make sure your accent stayed right?
Yeah, I was phoning it in, I suppose.
The very opposite.
Well, I don't know if in that case it was necessarily a function of working harder. It was just that I was working later, probably. It was more because I felt that I needed to catch up on some things that I had kind of overlooked. And yeah, so I would make some calls down to the embassy. And
a guy you knew or just like whoever answered?
You know, whoever answered.
Really?
So long as they were from Ethiopia, I just wanted to hear the rhythms and the intonation of their, you know, their speech patterns and stuff.
And would you try yours out on them or not dare?
No. I would just listen. I would just, you know, kind of listen with open ears and then try to recreate, you know, a few moments later.
And did your fellow filmmakers and actors know what the hell you were doing?
I think Jim Jarmusch at first was a bit confused and thought I was a little distracted and asking.
He's calling his agent.
What the heck is this guy doing over here? But in fact, yeah, he realized soon that it was all for the cause. So he was okay with it.
What happened to that grooving CD I burned for you?
It is. You mind?
Jeffrey Wright, this has been a pleasure. I thank you so much.
Well, I appreciate it, Kurt. Thank you for having me.
That's nice. Ethiopian sounds. It's good for the heart.
Jeffrey Wright is going to be all over the place this fall in Boardwalk Empire, as well as three feature films, supporting roles in A Single Shot, The Inevitable Defeat of Mr. and Pete, and the new installment of The Hunger Games.
Look, come over tomorrow for Sunday brunch, and we'll talk a little further about our investigative plan. So I'll leave that right there.
Go home and leave me alone.
care. Love you, too.
Still ahead this hour, sound artist Janet Cardiff makes a very old piece of music into something rivetingly new. I'll also talk with the writer Alice McDermott. She's just published her seventh novel, and it might remind you of the first six.
Friends and strangers came up to me on the street and say, "Oh, you're writing another novel. Is this another one about Irish Americans where somebody dies?"
That's up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity. Lumosity.com daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com. And by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting 12 Years a Slave, the true story of a man who overcame more than a decade of injustice to reclaim his freedom. Now playing.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. A lot of novels try to be like Hollywood movies these days, driven by high-concept premises and plots filled with obsession, violence, magic, special effects, spectacle. But not so much Alice McDermott's novels. She writes very realistically about very ordinary people living very ordinary lives, but she conjures characters and families and places with such fierce conviction and exquisite detail that you come away from her books feeling, A, you know these folks better than you know most flesh and blood humans in your life, and B, reminded that ordinary people possess extraordinary dimension and depth a lot of the time. Her new novel, The First in 7 Years, is called Someone, and Alice McDermott joins me now. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you so much.
So this book feels like, among other things, a celebration of a certain kind of woman who would never be noticed in life otherwise. And the title alone, Someone, seems like a declaration of that. Was that the intention?
Yes, to a large extent it was. She's the sort of character who not a lot of attention gets paid.
Unless she kills herself or somebody else, she's not going to get attention.
Right, or she's a terrible mother.
Yeah.
But she'll still be a minor character.
Yes. Is part of your intention also to get readers to notice things along with her?
Well, she is definitely the eyes of the novel. She is the eye of the first-person narration, and she is the eyes of the novel in that her myopia is sort of an extended way, a metaphor as a way of looking at the world.
Which is entirely plausible. It's not one of these characters who has the observational commentary ability of, say, a novelist
right,
implausible.
Right.
I wonder if you could read a passage from the book. Page 51.
51,
yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so what's going on right now?
This is Marie is now more or less in middle age. She's left Brooklyn. She's out on Long Island raising her family, but her brother and her mother have stayed in the old house, and Brooklyn is in decline. And the mother now is in literal physical decline, dying. She wakes up on occasion and fearfully asks if she's at home, meaning Ireland, and that's not where she wants to be. So her children, Gabe, Marie's brother, and Marie are trying to reassure her. I went ahead to pull the first door open and then slipped around them to get the outer door as well. There was a blast of heat. Gabe carried my mother into the sunlight and down the steps. There were kids on the stoop across the street. There was the tinny music from their transistor radios. They glared, open-mouthed. A pair of dark men passing by looked up as Gabe came down the stairs with my mother in his arms. They walked to the curb, glancing over their shoulders, giving him wide berth. Gabe, too, went to the curb and then turned around to look back up at the house. I rushed to scoop up the sheet and the blanket that was now brushing the sidewalk. "You're here, Mama," I heard him say, "where we've always lived." My mother raised her head. She extricated one thin hand from the winding bedclothes and raised it to her eyes against the sun. She looked down the street and then up at our building, the blue summer light reflecting in the glass of the front door, the bowed parlor window, some plywood there too, and then up to the fourth floor, where a bit of lace curtain, her handiwork, had been drawn through the opened window. "Not home," I heard Gabe telling her, reassuring her. "Brooklyn."
That was Alice MacDermott reading from her new novel, Someone. And I love that passage partly because it seems to me, if we were going to make a trailer for this novel, it would be it, because it's so much about this particular place and that, you know, sort of seeing is believing beyond any fantasy or wishfulness.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And the place transforming itself even as they're living there.
You mentioned before your contrariness, and you mentioned a lot that you're a contrarian and you're stubborn. What does that, beyond writing a novel about this ordinary, apparently uninteresting woman, for instance, what other kinds of decisions does that stubborn contrarianism drive in you?
Well, I suppose my immediate thought about that is the spiritual aspect, if I can say spiritual aspect, of the novel. And the sense for me, once I understood the story and the novel was essentially composing itself in some degree, I realized that really what this was about was, as a child, Marie questions sort of offhandedly her pious brother reciting Matthew to his families about
her priest-to-be brother,
that all the hairs on our heads are counted and two sparrows are sold for small coin and we are more valued than many sparrows. She calls him a fool. She calls him the Irish word for fool, which she had just picked up out on the street, Amadon. And the more I saw that's exactly what this novel is about. Do we believe that? Does anyone believe that all the hairs on our heads are counted? Every ordinary one of us, that our lives in some way have a shape that is in some ways not necessarily inevitable, but someone's watching out for us.
Only authors are. Only in fiction are they, maybe.
Well, that may be. And if it's only in fiction, well, then it's a good question. Why? What is the fictional impulse to make order? Where does that come from?
From being God.
There you go.
Well, you've said in an interview that recognizing the things that make literature a work of art have made me a Christian in a way that being raised a Catholic never did. Is this what you're talking about?
I think that's very much it. Yeah, I think that's and so as a writer and not feeling that you're playing God with your characters, but that you are some way actually putting yourself at the service of the story rather than creating and manipulating the story to see what happens. And in this book, it was a surprise to me. I wasn't sure which side the book was going to come down, the pious priest who says we are all more valuable than sparrows, or Marie who says that's nonsense. Look, we're dying all the time and nobody's paying any attention.
And is that your approach as a writer in general to not know for certain what you think of these characters or their predicament at the beginning, but discover it?
I'm very careful, I hope, to avoid that. I don't really have a point to make if I want to convince somebody of something.
Send a telegram.
I'll send a telegram, right? Or write a blog.
Or back in the day, this day, you would have sent a telegram. This book, obviously, is about a family. You write a lot about families. What did yours think of their girl deciding to become a writer? And I say girl because that obviously had meaning in 1970, whatever.
Exactly. Yes. They were very worried about the very notion of such a thing. And in some ways, I'm of that generation of parents as soon as our children show any interest at all in anything, we sign them up for classes and begin to promote their careers. And it was quite opposite for my generation of children. So when I even in college made any kind of noise about maybe this was something I wanted to do, my parents, with all good intentions, said, you know, if you go to Katie Gibbs, which is a secretarial school, and learn to take dictation and get your typing skills up, you could work for a publishing house. And then at night, when you came home, you could write your little stories.
And dictation and typing would have been so useful these days.
Exactly right.
And you write short stories as well. Do short stories sometimes sort of their own volition bloom into novels?
Yeah, I haven't had that happen. I've had things that I've started not quite sure what they would be and then realized that they were a novel or a short novel.
Uh-huh.
I'm not at first a short story writer. I always think if I were really, really, if I were a really, really wonderful writer, I'd be a poet. If I were a really wonderful writer, I'd be a short story writer. And I'm not quite up there yet, so I need a novel.
But you're not a long novel writer. Have you ever thought, I should write a really long novel, or I should write a novel starring Moors in medieval Spain or something?
Oh, I think that all the time.
Yeah?
Yes, yeah. And sometimes, certainly when friends and strangers came up to me on the street and say, oh, you're writing another novel. Is this another one about Irish Americans where somebody dies? But you do what you can, what your material is what your material is. And I'm not terribly interested, actually, in Irish Americans in New York or anywhere else in the 20th century. Honestly.
Really? You could fool us.
I know. I'm glad that other people are. But I'm interested in what it is to be human, to make it through a life, to think that you're a fool to believe that someone's watching over this and there's any shape to our lives, or to be someone who believes there is. The rest is just details.
Alice McDermott, it has been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Alice McDermott is the author of 7 novels, the latest of which is Someone, and it's out now. The music you're hearing is old. It's one of the great choral works of the 1500s. But it's the heart of an artwork that is extremely now. It's called 40-Part Motet, and it was made by the Canadian sound artist Janet Cardiff. 40-Part Motet is currently installed at the Cloisters, an imitation medieval museum in its own park at the tip of Manhattan, and WNYC's Jamie York has been spending a lot of time with it.
I'm here this morning by myself. Those voices that you're hearing are recorded. They're singers who are about to sing a piece of choral music. The music lasts 11 minutes, but Janet Cardiff's piece is a 14-minute loop. So the first 3 minutes are just this, people chatting before they start to sing.
As you enter the room, as you go in through the doors, then you see 40 black speaker stands with speakers on top of them.
Spaced evenly in a big oval. Stand in the center, it sounds like this. Go up to any one of the speakers, and you can hear a voice.
Each individual speaker is an individual singer.
Cardiff recorded each of these singers on their own mic. If you put your ear to the speaker, it's like someone's mouth is directly beside your ear. You can hear somebody whispering. You can hear these kids talking about a watch.
I used to have that watch.
And you can even hear this guy talking about being hungover.
I'm very hungover.
And so then you realize that, yeah, these are real people.
More than stereo headphones, more than IMAX, this is what it's really like to hear in a space.
I have a particular love of sound around me, being enveloped, I guess it is. It's sort of, it's a very sensual thing. It reproduces the way we really hear if you have stereo hearing, so that you can hear something to your left and hear something to your right. And that's a really primitive thing. It's why our ears are built the way they are, so that we can hear bears behind us and we know where the lion is that's coming.
Cardiff first heard this music on a CD somebody gave her.
Spaminalium by Thomas Tallis. It's an amazing piece of music that has 40 different harmonies from around 1556. I put it on my stereo when I got home, and immediately I was infatuated with music, but at the same time I was totally frustrated because I wanted to hear the 40 different harmonies. I wanted to hear how they would go up and down and all around, and I just envisioned right away this choir around me. And I know that some choirs actually do the singing in the round. And that was one reason that I wanted to place it in an oval.
She called her piece the 40-part motet, and it was first installed in the U.S. in 2001 at a museum called PS1 in New York. Peter Ely is the curator there.
It's important, I think, to also consider the visual impact of what she designed, because the speakers themselves are installed at roughly head height. If you saw a single speaker alone, it might not occur to you that there's something inherently human-like about a speaker on a stand 5.5 feet off the ground. Once it dawns on you, and it does quite quickly, what's going on, you, in a sense, are looking at a room of 40 effigies for the singers themselves.
In some ways, those speakers are more like people than people are. I don't really ever get to hear a stranger breathe or to walk among a choir listening to the vulnerability of one person singing. It reminds me of this movie that was one of my favorites when I was a kid called Wings of Desire. I watched it and rewatched it. In the movie, angels walk unseen among the living in Berlin. There's a scene where the angels walk around a crowded library. They'll sidle up to somebody and hear his internal monologue, always insecurities, regrets, disappointments, desires. And then they somehow reassure him. Waking up every morning in New York City, I dream about doing that. Cardiff's piece gives me that intimacy with someone I don't know who talks to me as though I'm not here.
The intimacy that you get from a person's voice, it feels like it's on the back of your neck. There's a sense of safety in technology, but at the same time, there's a sense of connection. You don't lose the connection of the human voice, but you get the safety of not having to stand right next to that person.
Janet Cardiff's husband, George Miller, wanted to know more about a singer he felt attached to. I think it's this man.
There's a bass that is George's favorite, and also one of my favorites, too. And then George just thought, oh, well, I'll check out his name on the internet, see what he's up to, and I found a funeral service for him. And so then I stood over by him in New York, and it just struck me in a completely different way.
Walking through the piece and hearing a variety of voices moving in and moving out gives me a feeling of place and of time that I really can't, I'm not sure of. Transcending is the right word. Maybe it's being in the piece at the moment. I got a little teary.
I was a little bit uncomfortable.
What the work does, the position that it puts you in, is really one of a ghost.
Yeah, I mean, it felt like each one of the speakers is almost like a stand-in for a person, but in that way, you know, it felt kind of like a monument. There's this object, and there's the presence of the voice, but you know, you can't connect or make eye contact with the person that's, you know, whose voice is filling the space.
And I think that's a huge part of what's unsettling and at the same time magical about the work, is that you can move through it unnoticed by the same people who otherwise would seem to be noticing you and yet aren't there.
It's not just the ghostliness of the piece. I think it also has to do with this beautiful music that comes entirely from bodies, fragile and ephemeral as we know they are. I've actually sung in choirs in the cathedral where this was recorded, and I know how transcendent it feels to be part of that larger, soaring sound. I also know how fleeting that feeling is. How quickly we return to struggling with our own imperfect line of notes. How often we go off key.
It's that those imperfect parts are very close to the imperfections we know and feel about ourselves.
Peter Ely, the curator from PS1.
The work becomes a shorthand for how we know the world to work. You have these things that we encounter in collective forms, whether it's going to the movies or a football game or voting, where we feel ourselves inscribed within the collective culture. And then at the same time, as we move about our lives on a given day, we mostly feel isolated from that.
We all experience this piece differently. We all know a desire for connection. And we all feel alone. I don't know of another work of art that conveys so well these essential aspects of being alive. For Studio 360, I'm Jamie York.
Janet Cardiff's 40-part motet is up in New York at the Metropolitan Museum's Cloisters until December 8th. You can watch a performance of Thomas Tallis's Spem in Allium at studio360.org. And that's it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, we really do want your suggestions for the final segment in this season of American Icons. What book, movie, painting, song, or whatever best embodies America? The deadline is Sunday the 27th. You can hear all of the American Icons we've done so far on our website, studio360.org. And if you're more the smartphone or tablet type, now you can check them all out on Flipboard, too. Just search Studio 360. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel, Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Posey Gruner,
Eric Malinsky,
Julie Dorio,
Dylan Piers McCoy,
Felicity Sheehy,
Zachary McCune.
And thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
Studio 360 is supported by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, Art Works. Studio 360's American Icons project is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Great ideas brought to life.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, novelist Tom Perata, the author of Little Children, on a classic novel of adultery.
The real crime isn't desire, it's hypocrisy. And I think that's a specific American view of sex.
Nathaniel Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter from our series American Icons, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.